Good evening, everyone. And Itai, thank you very much for that introduction. You know, another thing we share in common is a passion for this great country, the opportunities that we have, and we see we both see the potential. And so it's really pleasing to see so many people come here tonight to talk about that potential and to listen over the next couple of days. The organisers have kind of found a fantastic venue for us. You've really got kind of we're sitting here really between two of Sydney's world-famous icons. So thank you, and I hope you're enjoying that. And I hope you also find your visit to Australia useful from a business perspective. I'm sure you will. In just a short period, you're going to be able to talk to leaders from the worlds of business, politics, the investment community, and the policy institutions. You'll find an openness and transparency in Australia that you don't see everywhere else around the world, and I hope and I'm sure that you'll experience a genuine willingness to share perspectives and a genuine openness and transparency. You'll also find a country that is prosperous and wealthy. Australians enjoy a standard of living that few people around the world enjoy. You'll find a country that's grown consistently for some decades now, despite a pretty difficult global environment. Australia's year-end growth rate's been in positive territory since 1991. You find a country with a stable and strong banking system. We have deep and liquid financial markets. The public here question why banks are so profitable, not why they performed so badly during the financial crisis. You'll find a country that is well-placed to benefit from the growth in Asia, as Andrew talked about, not only because of our natural resource base, which is extensive, but also because of the strong demand for our food and the wide range of services that our talented workforce can produce. You'll find a country with a growing and a diverse population and that has a high degree of social cohesion. In recent years, our population's been growing at around 1.5% a year, which is quite fast for a developed country. And around 40% of us were either born overseas or who have one parent who was born overseas. This brings us a dynamism that isn't there in countries with stagnant and less diverse populations. You also find a country with strong public institutions, and as Andrew said, an economy which is resilient and flexible. We do have a demonstrated capacity to address our problems and to adjust to the changing world we live in. In the past decade, this flexibility has meant that we've been able to maintain a high degree of stability through the biggest resources boom in a century and then the subsequent unwinding of that boom. You also find a country with positive interest rates and a conventional monetary policy framework. The central bank is independent, it's analytical, and it's pragmatic. Our inflation target is focused on medium-term outcomes, and this approach means that we have the flexibility to take into account developments in balance sheets and financial stability considerations that isn't always possible in more rigid frameworks. So that's Australia. Again, welcome. I'm sure you'll find a lot to see here that you like. In the spirit of openness and transparency, though, that I mentioned a few moments ago, we're not without our challenges, and I want to talk about a few of those in a few minutes. But first, I want to say a few words about openness to trade and investment and the role that it's played in Australia's prosperity. Australia is a country that has benefited greatly from the open international trading system. Our ability to sell to the world goods that we can produce really effectively has boosted our living standards. We also benefit from being able to import goods overseas, and the need to compete with others is one of the things that causes us to strive to do things even better. Australians have also benefited from the free flow of financial capital. Year after year, for more than 200 years now, we've needed the savings from the rest of the world to help build this country. If we'd had to rely just on our own resources, we would not be enjoying the prosperity that we do today. Our asset base would be smaller, our productive capacity would be smaller, and so too would our standard of living. As investors, Australians have also benefited from being able to diversify their portfolios internationally and by being able to build strong businesses overseas. So again, that is Australia. We provide a very good illustration of a medium-term country that's committed to a rules-based open international order, that has believes in a strong role for markets and has a floating exchange rate, and that has a largely open capital account, and that has a dynamic and innovative financial sector. We provide a good illustration that a country with all those things can prosper in today's complex world. And I'm confident that we will continue to provide an example to the world here. I promised openness and transparency, and that means talking about some of the challenges, so I'd like to go through a few of those. The first is the need to reinvigorate productivity growth. Australia, like many advanced economies over recent times, has experienced slower productivity growth. In our case, that's partly because of the large investment in the resources sector that we were making. In recent years, though, as that investment has tailed off, the productivity figures have picked up a little bit. And that's good news, but there is an underlying structural slowdown in productivity growth in our country. It reflects a number of structural factors. If we don't address those factors, then we are going to have to get used to slower growth in our living standards than we have become used to over recent decades. In some ways, this adjustment has already started, and it's proving difficult for many citizens and for governments. On the more positive side, there's no shortage of things that we can do to lift our performance. The challenge is that most of the things that we can think of to do involve very difficult political trade-offs. So they're not easy to do, but there are things we can do. A related challenge, and again touching on Andrew's comments, is how to best capitalise on the opportunities that we have in Asia. We benefited greatly from the surge in commodity prices last decade and from the rapid growth in the rest of the region and strong demand for our food products, for our tourism, for education, and for many of the business services that we're very good at producing. But it is a competitive world out there, and other countries see these opportunities too. So we need to find ways of building on our strengths to bring goods and services to the Asian market at competitive prices. And again, lifting our productivity has to be the right place to start here. A third issue is the task of providing adequate high-quality infrastructure to help our citizens to be as productive as they can be and enjoy a high standard of living. As I said earlier, our population is growing strongly, and this is a source of dynamism for our economy. But this growth puts strains on our infrastructure, including on transport infrastructure. Unfortunately, these strains can reduce public support for a growing population. They can also impair our ability to compete and to be as productive as we can be. Good transport infrastructure opens up opportunities for people and it opens markets. It also improves communities and people's lives. Good transport can also play a very important role in addressing housing affordability, which is an increasingly important issue in our country. Infrastructure investment does, of course, need to be paid for. The positive news here is that there's no shortage of finance for the right projects, and some of this finance is in this room. The task we face then is to identify the right projects, harness the planning capacity of governments, design the best deal structures to attract private finance where it makes sense to do so, make sure that the construction process is as efficient as possible, and price of the use of the infrastructure appropriately. They're all challenging things to do, but they're not impossible for a country with our ability. The final issue I want to mention this evening is that of ensuring the public finances are on the right track. Australia has a very good record here. Net government debt as a share of GDP is still low. It's higher than it used to be, but it is still low. Our good record here has given us a form of insurance. It meant that when difficult times did strike last decade, fiscal policy did have the capacity to play an important stabilising role in the economy. And we had options that not all countries in the world enjoyed. Looking forward, we need to make sure that we continue to have that insurance. And we can do that by rebuilding our fiscal buffers. This too is a challenging thing to do, particularly given the additional demands that are being placed on government. A related complication is that simultaneously we need to make sure that our tax system is internationally competitive. And one example of this complication is in the area of corporate tax, where there is a form of international tax competition going on in an effort to attract foreign investment. Like other countries, we face the difficult challenge of responding to this international competition while achieving a reasonable balance between recurrent spending and fiscal revenue. So there's some of the issues we face. Of course, there are other ones as well, and no doubt you'll talk about these tonight and tomorrow as well. I'd like to finish up by turning to the near-term outlook for the Australian economy. The Reserve Bank will be releasing updated detailed forecasts tomorrow in our quarterly statement on monetary policy. For 2017 and 18, these forecasts will show little change to our earlier forecasts. Over the next couple of years, we expect GDP growth in Australia to be around the 3% mark. In both years, it's going to be boosted by a significant increase in LNG production. And the headwinds that we've been experiencing from the unwinding of the mining investment boom will blow themselves out. Indeed, we're almost 90% of the way through the fall from the peak in mining investment to the expected trough. And another headwind that we've had over recent years, that's the declining commodity prices, has already blown itself out. Since earlier last year, the rise in global commodity prices has provided a significant boost to our national income, and the current improvement we're seeing in the global economy is going to help us as well. So with the end of the unwinding of the mining boom coming to an end, our economy is in reasonable shape. Unexpectedly, GDP did fall in the September quarter, but this largely reflected a confluence of temporary factors. We expect that in the December quarter, the economy will have returned to reasonable growth. Inflation remains low, running at around 1.5% in headline and underlying terms. Importantly, inflation isn't expected to fall further. Instead, our central forecast is for underlying inflation to gradually rise over the next couple of years and for headline inflation to increase a bit more quickly, boosted by increases in oil and tobacco prices. We continue to pay very close attention to the housing market and to household balance sheets. And here the picture varies very significantly across the country. Prices for houses in Sydney and Melbourne are rising very strongly, but apartment prices in some cities, including in Perth and Brisbane, are falling. The population's growing very strongly, but there's a large increase in additional supply coming onto the market over the next couple of years. Growth in rents is weak, but vacancy rates in most markets are not unusually high. And investor demand for residential property looks to have strengthened in the closing months of last year. So it's quite a complex picture. There is not such a thing as the Australian housing market. One reason for trying to understand this complex picture is that the level of household debt in Australia is relatively high. Overall, households are coping pretty well with the high level of debt. But there are clearly risks here. So it is a positive development that over the past couple of years, banks have tightened their lending standards in the housing market. The tightening was partly prompted by the supervisory measures taken by APRA, and APRA and the Reserve Bank continue to work very closely monitoring developments in this area. Another issue that we're paying close attention to is developments in the labour market. Employment growth did slow considerably over 2016, and the growth that did take place was almost exclusively in part-time employment. This is the case of the housing market, though the picture varies significantly across the country. In some areas, the labour market's very strong, in others, they're quite weak. If we look forward, the various measures of job vacancies and job ads that we track suggest some strengthening in employment growth over the next little while. And so our central forecast is that the unemployment rate is going to remain around the current level of 5.75% for a while yet. So in summary, The bank's central scenario is for some pickup in economic growth in Australia and for inflation to move gradually higher. The ways there are risks around that outlook. But our record demonstrates that our economy has a degree of resilience and flexibility that has allowed us to maintain stability during a difficult period in the global economy, and there's no reason at all that that can't continue. But we do need to make sure that we continue to build resilience while we take advantage of the very considerable opportunities that we have as a nation. Thank you very much. Welcome again. Enjoy your time in Australia, and I'd be happy to answer a few questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And just a bit of housekeeping. So the Q&A tonight, we'll first take questions from our guests, and then we'll be able to take a few questions for the media afterwards. Maybe just to get the questions started, Dr. Lowe, I'll ask one. Obviously, we've entered a different global political environment, both with Brexit and obviously the election of Donald Trump, which may both have significant changes for the U.S. economy and significant changes in the volatility of that outcome. How does the Reserve Bank see those risks, and how does it see forecasting what's likely going to be a shift?
Well, I think like many others, we're in watch and wait mode. It's very difficult to predict how the new U.S. administration is going to affect economic policy. It's quite possible that the outcomes are good. The increased spending on infrastructure, reducing regulation, and cutting corporate tax are things that the G20, which I go to often, have really been calling for to stimulate growth. And to some degree, that's at the core of President Trump's domestic political message. So if that works and serves as an example to others, then that could be very good for global growth. And Andrew also touched on that. It could turn out very badly, though. This is why we're going watch and wait mode. If we do see a retreat from open international order, then the U.S. economy will be weaker, the world economy will be weaker. It surely can't be the case that the way we build prosperity is to build barriers between one another. That can't be how we build prosperity. So if that happens, and we don't know whether it's going to happen, it could be in the world of politics, and you know, in the end we see a retreat and more common sense prevails. So watching, waiting.
Happy to take questions.
Thank you for your words, Governor Lowe. I was very much interested in your comments about the need for infrastructure spending, not only obviously in Australia but around the world. Australia may be the 51st ranked country by population, but we're fourth by pension funds, and 92% of those assets are invested in secondary markets. So do you think there's a role for our pension system to invest more in infrastructure assets? And what do you think could be done to actually facilitate that?
I don't think the issue we face here is a lack of finance. You know, there are people from right around the world here who would love to buy Australian infrastructure and get the stable, predictable returns in a country with strong legal system, strong economic growth. So there is no issue with the supply of finance. The issue is the supply of projects that are attractive to investors, either new projects or existing projects. So I think that's the area for us to focus on. How can we as a country develop new projects that are attractive to the investment community and that serve the interests of our community? There's increased spending on infrastructure at the moment would help with aggregate demand. It would build supply capacity in the Australian economy. It would make people's lives better, and it would provide strong, stable investments for people. So kind of on so many dimensions, it's tick, 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 tick. The challenge we face is using the planning capacity of government together with the private sector to come up with the projects that we can invest in and generate a return both for the investment community and for the society. It's difficult, as I said, but it should not be beyond our capability as a clever nation to do this.
Great.
Hi, Scott Berg with T. Rowe. Just wondering if you could make some comments about your outlook for global interest rates over the last couple of months. Post the Trump election, obviously global inflation expectations have picked up a bit, and we've seen a bit of a turn there. Can you just talk about from your standpoint and the data you see, and look globally, how you think about the moving pieces there and the risk that we see, some more extreme movements there, either up or back down a bit?
Yeah, well, in the last 2 months, we've seen a really turn around, because through much of last year, remember, up until September, investors were prepared to pay governments to look after their money for up to 10 years. Presumably that was because they're incredibly risk-averse, or they thought the interest rates would never rise, and that was the best thing they could think to do with their money, to give it to a government and look after it. Thankfully, those days look like they're behind us. Unless something goes badly wrong in the global economy again, I would be surprised if we saw further monetary easing by the major central banks. The US is clearly on a path to tightening, which is good news, and I'd be surprised if the other major central banks cut interest rates or did further monetary expansion. And that's good. It's signalling that the global economy is healing after the financial crisis. In Europe, we haven't had any missteps for a while. The Chinese are committed to achieving their growth targets. They've really done what they said they would do, partly because of strong credit-financed property expenditure, but they've done that, and the US economy is full employment, and the labour market there is strong. So I think the Japanese economy is doing a bit better as well. So right across the board, the major economies are looking more healthy than they did last year, and if that continues, then the days of further monetary easing are behind us, and that's good.
In terms of the risk to the upside, do you worry at all that they go up too far, too soon?
Well, I worry about lots of things, but it's good news that if they start to go up more broadly than the US, I think that would be good news. We should not be fearful of a rise in global interest rates. It will occur with a rise in global growth. So that's a process that, if that's what's happened, we should welcome it. You know, you can think of scenarios where the thing gets out of control and inflation picks up very quickly and market interest rates have to move very quickly. So you can, if you're inclined to, you can think of scenarios that are not very attractive. But the central scenario, I think, is a much better one than we were looking at in the middle of last year, and certainly at the beginning of last year when you met in Sydney, the global environment was quite fragile. There was all this concern about China. Commodity prices were falling. It was a very kind of much more fragile environment than the one we face today.
Dr. Liu, you cited a mixed housing outlook for Australia. It's a very complicated situation here, as it has always been. How do you think about housing from a financial stability perspective versus inflation? How do you think about that balance between the two in regards to setting of monetary policy?
I think there are two considerations here. One is that the traditional one would be kind of a decline in the housing market. What impact would have that on the banking system, on the stability of the banking system? That's not something that I really worry about. Because of the... Where's Wayne over there? Because of the efforts that APRA has been taken... that is taken together with the efforts of the banks themselves. I think the banks are pretty resilient against even quite bad scenarios in the housing market. So that's not a particular issue at the moment. The other consideration is just not so much the housing prices, but the run-up in debt that's gone along with the higher housing prices, that at some point in the future the household sector might feel that the level of debt is just too high, particularly if housing prices were to come back, and that if they did come to think that the level of debt is too high, then consumption could be very weak for a period of time as they sought to rebuild their balance sheet. So that is a consideration in thinking about monetary policy, because I don't think it's in our interest to encourage people to borrow more, to push up house prices even more just to get a bit more growth this quarter or next, because I think we could later on come to rue the day that the level of debt went up even higher. So it's a consideration There are others as well, but that is one consideration that we talk about at the Reserve Bank. And because our inflation target is a flexible medium-term one, we have the kind of the flexibility to take that into account. I want to make sure that over my 7 years, just as Glenn did over his 7 years, that inflation averages 2 point something, and I'm confident we're going to do that. But we don't feel compelled to get inflation back to 2.5 at the earliest opportunity if it comes at the cost of higher levels of debt.
Maybe let's take one more question from the guests, and then we'll turn it over to the media. Sorry.
Having trouble seeing it.
Hi, Kevin McSweeney from CI Investments in Toronto. Could you talk about your approach to either interpreting currency movements or how you integrate currency movements or volatility into kind of your monetary policy?
Well, the currency movements obviously affect the forecast for both output and inflation kind of in the standard way, and that's part of our normal forecasting suite. We have the exchange rate in there. How do we think about the currency? The Australian dollar, really over since the period since it floated quite a few decades ago, has been very heavily influenced by movements in commodity prices. And that's been incredibly stabilising for the Australian economy. I think kind of the movement in the Australian dollar is probably more stabilising for the economy than movements in our short-term interest rate. In the peak of the resources boom, if the currency hadn't gone up as high as it did, we would have had overheating, would have had asset price problems, inflation would have been high, it would have been very problematic. And then as the mining boom came off, the currencies come down. So it doesn't always move exactly as you would like it, but the broad sweep of history is that it's done pretty much the right thing and been a stabilising thing for the economy. I think one of the issues that we face globally at the moment is many central banks have, or many governments, have wanted lower currencies. And you're starting to see this in the US now with various parts of the US administration being concerned about the value of the yen and the yuan and the euro. So it would be problematic for us and for the world if currency manipulation seemed to become a way to generate growth. I hope that doesn't happen, but for us, the Australian dollar has been the great stabiliser. That's basically how I think about it.
Okay, let's take questions from the media. Would any of the media like to ask a question?
No.
Good. Governor Jacob Greber from the Australian Financial Review, right? Here in the darkness.
Okay. Thank you.
Where some say we belong. A quick question. Notwithstanding what you said about the upside to a Trump administration, you mentioned really quickly there that, you know, reducing regulations might be a thing that helps. Do you have any concerns about a wind back, for instance, on Dodd-Frank, given that many people see the sort of the arrangement before the global financial crisis was one of the reasons we got into the trouble we got into, and now the pendulum's going back with Trump towards looser regulations? The Reserve Bank's obviously fought in all of these forums around the world to put its view across. Are we going backwards or forwards here?
Well, again, we're in watch and wait mode. We don't know how this is going to play out. Some adjustment to elements of Dodd-Frank might be entirely sensible and may actually improve the efficiency of the financial system without impairing its stability. So we have to see exactly what the nature of the changes are. One concern that I have is a retreat from the rules-based global system, because if the US decides to go its own way, that might increase the incentive for Europe to go its own way, or for Japan or China to go their own way. And if we lose the common denominator across the world for financial regulation, I think we'll all suffer because of that. We'll lose the level playing field, the system will become less efficient and more prone to arbitrage as people try and move funds around or businesses around to take advantage of that. So it's not necessarily the change in financial regulation that concerns me most. It's a possible retreat from a commitment to an international rules-based common system. That's a concern, and we don't know whether the US will ultimately move away from that, but you have seen in recent times the Federal Reserve and others being instructed not to participate in international negotiations in foreign lands, which I think is problematic. If that takes us to the place where the US cannot be part of the rules-based international order, that's a more concern to me than movements in particular regulation. Thank you.
Sophia Rodriguez from Market News. In his final speech as the Assistant Governor for Economics, Dr. Kent talked about the increase in commodity prices and increase in terms of trade as a tail breeze for the economy. I was disappointed because I didn't see tailwind in your speech today. I was expecting that breeze to have turned to wind by now. How would you characterize it?
I have to admit that I can't remember what exactly Dr. Kent said, but the movement in the terms of trade is boosting our national income at the moment, which is good news. It's pushing up equity prices, and hopefully the government will get some extra revenue as well, and it improves confidence in the economy. So that's a positive. We're not expecting the higher commodity prices to lead to much more investment. We've done so much investment in the resources sector, so unless the prices were to stay high for a long period of time, I don't think we'll see a reinvigoration of investment. Expecting iron ore prices and coal prices to come back a bit as the supply adjusts. So we're not expecting it to kind of be a major boost to the economy, but it is helping. So it's going to help with revenue, it helps with equity prices, and helps with confidence. And it's a much better situation than the one we've had for the last 4 years, when each year they've been down, down, down. Thank you.
Right, we'll take one final question.
Dr. Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg. Just wondering if I could bring you back to the currency. You mentioned for quite some time in your statements that that if it rose, if it appreciated, it could complicate the adjustment. Presumably the adjustment's still going on, but if it's going up, which it has been, I think it was up 5% last month, at what, how far off or how close are we starting to get to it complicating the adjustment? Presumably it does impact tourism and education and these services exports that we want to really get going.
You said it, rightly, that it's gone up recently, but a little before that it went down. And so at least against the US dollar, we're pretty much the same as kind of we averaged through a large part of last year. So there hasn't been a kind of and commodity prices are a reasonable amount higher, so that it's understandable the Australian dollar would be a little higher. The way that ultimately we judge this is whether the configuration of interest rates and the exchange rate we've got are delivering reasonable growth. And our central forecast at the moment is that they will deliver reasonable growth, 3%, which by the standards of many Western countries is pretty good. I think that's our central forecast for the next couple of years. So while ever that's the case, it's hard to say that the exchange rate's kind of fundamentally too high or... If the global outlook were to change and the exchange rate, interest rate combination led to growth being downgraded, then you could make a case that the exchange rate was too high. But at the moment, I struggle to say the configuration that we have is leading to growth outcomes that aren't satisfactory.
So, Dr. Lowe, I'd like to thank you on behalf of all of us for your own economic openness and representing the absolute best of Australia. So please, thank you very much.
Thank you.